Okay. Well, thanks to Lars, and thanks to you all for having me be here. If nothing else, it gave me a chance to walk from my end of the campus all the way to what I consider to be the science end, where the really nice ocean views are, and that's always a real treat. And the blurb that that Lars read from the back of my book is actually fairly appropriate for today's talk, because that's sort of what I'm going to be focusing on. I'm going to talk about a couple large telescope projects that never really quite made it past the blueprint stage, with the idea of maybe giving some insights into the plans and processes for the next round of telescope building that the astronomy community seems poised to undertake in the next decade or so. The act of building these big facilities for astronomy has, in many ways, I like to see it as an act of faith, because of the amount of time and commitment that is required on the part of people who are involved with getting these proposals off the ground and participating in the various science working groups and going to the ever-expanding array of meetings that are involved with planning these sorts of things. So what you oftentimes see is this incredible investment of time and energy and people's careers into these projects, and in some cases these investments pay off. And in many cases, they're not just investments on the part of people, but they're the investments also for the countries that are involved in building these. I can't recall the name of the Japanese space telescope that was lost not so long ago, but obviously that was a major disappointment for the, not only for the Japanese, but for the scientists who were involved with it. One of the first things I learned when I started this project 4 or 5 years ago, and granted, as Lars pointed out, I came into this having practically no background at all, knowing very little about astronomy. And this seemed to, little cartoon seemed to capture pretty much the essence of what I needed to know. And pretty much also seemed to encapsulate the last 50 years of American astronomy, this quest for ever bigger and ever more powerful telescopes. The American astronomy community, and indeed the international astronomy community in the last, since about 1985, has been enormously successful in overcoming what I describe in my book as the Palomar paradigm, the idea that it wasn't possible, or at least it was going to be financially crippling, to build large ground-based optical telescopes that were bigger than the 200-inch or 5-meter telescope at Palomar. And indeed, the Palomar design, as I argue in the book, pretty much established a paradigm for the way in which astronomers and telescope engineers conceived of building telescopes. The idea of having this large monolithic mirror and an equatorial mount for it, sort of this large classical shaped dome. And the Palomar design also established a cost size paradigm that, at least into the 1970s, astronomers were finding it difficult to break away from. And it was only with some innovative telescopes such as the Multiple Mirror Telescope, which was dedicated on Mount Hopkins in 1979, that astronomers were able to break away from this. So this telescope revolution of the 20th century seems to be capable of being described in a number of different ways. One of them is that astronomers were able to demonstrate to the patrons that fund their projects that not only were bigger telescopes possible, but they were also affordable. And I say this, of course, in relative terms, because I'm a historian, and in my department, getting a $20,000 grant is cause for champagne. And having hung out at NASA meetings where, you know, $100 bills are being passed out to write people's addresses on, it's a slightly different world. The other part of the telescope revolution, of course, is the idea that you began to see a synergy, beginning in the late 60s and then accelerating through the 70s and 80s, a synergy between space and ground-based telescopes, culminating, of course, with the NASA Great Observatories program with Chandra and Hubble and Spitzer and those facilities. And finally, astronomers seem to cross the threshold in developing new ways of funding and organizing and using these telescopes. And my book focuses a lot on how the telescopes are used, but for today we'll talk more about the funding and organizing. It used to be in the early part of the 20th century that if you wanted to build a big ground-based telescope, you would go find yourself a sugar daddy like Charles Lick, or Yerkes or somebody like that and tap into them, and they would provide the funds to build your telescope, and then you would name it after them. And I guess that pattern still holds a little bit today. But by and large, astronomers have managed to overcome some of the institutional barriers and develop consortia and more creative ways of funding and organizing their facilities. And today, of course, you know, when I give this talk to historians, I have to explain what all these are, but I'll assume that a lot of this is familiar to this audience. Coming from the 2000 National Academy of Sciences Decadal Review, two of the major recommendations, of course, were to build a next-generation space telescope, which was to be an 8-meter class telescope in space, optimized for near-infrared and infrared observing, as well as to make some headway towards building a 30-meter ground-based telescope. And these projects are both underway. The University of California, of course, is participating in the 30-meter project at an institutional level, and I'm aware that many astronomers from the different UC campuses are participating in what's now called the James Webb Space Telescope in a variety of different ways. Just as an aside, if for no other reason, this will become a famous project because it'll be the first telescope named after an administrator, not a scientist. We have Hubble and Spitzer and Chandra, and now we're going to have the Webb Space Telescope. So for those of you who are thinking of careers in administration, the future is bright. So I've sort of organized my talk today around two different case studies, one of them being a plan that Kitt Peak National Observatory had to build a major new national facility in the 1970s. So let's talk about that first. In the early 1970s, Kitt Peak had completed its 4-meter telescope at Kitt Peak, and there was also a second 4-meter telescope at Cerro Tololo being finished. And the director of Kitt Peak, a solar astronomer by the name of Leo Goldberg, who was the director then, initiated what became known as the Next Generation Telescope. This was a project that began in 1974 at Kitt Peak, and it started very slowly. Goldberg had several different reasons for pursuing this. First of all, after having just completed a big round of telescope building, he found himself having a lot of telescope engineers on his staff, and being a good administrator, he wanted to keep them employed, and one of the ways to keep them employed was to encourage them to think about new big projects. He also was a major advocate for building up the National Observatory System, and he believed very strongly that the health of the National Observatory System was going to be predicated on building ever larger and more grandiose telescopes. So after a couple of years of summer work, remember Kitt Peak in southern Arizona, and when the monsoons hit there, oftentimes your summer afternoons are spent with not a whole lot to do because of the lightning storms. The telescope engineers and few astronomers who were involved had come up with a number of different possible designs for a 25-meter telescope. Some of them are shown here. They range from this thing, which was something that they called the steerable dish, basically an optical analog of a large single-dish radio telescope. They had proposed a variation on the multiple mirror telescope project by putting a whole bunch of mirrors on a single mount, unfortunately with a lot of metal in front of it, so I'm not exactly sure how that would have worked for infrared work. One of their more interesting ideas, at least to my mind, was instead of building one massive facility, somebody said, well, why don't we build 50 2-meter telescopes? We'll put them all in one place. And this problem that we seem to be having with our graduate students and our colleagues of getting access to facilities will be alleviated by this, because there will now be a whole slew of small 2-meter telescopes, and we'll design them in such a way that the light will be able to be combined at a common focus, and because these will sort of be built sequentially, we'll be able to use them as they're being built. This idea didn't go over very well with the NSF, and one of the reviewers of the proposal called this idea the Pygmy Village idea, because if you imagine all the little domes, that's sort of the image that they were left with. I think another reviewer called it the mushroom patch idea. Another idea that they had was, and the reviewers of this proposal weren't terribly charitable, this was what the reviewers called the rotating shoe. I think they were thinking of a Converse high top. But the designers at Kitt Peak, perhaps tapping into the fascination in American culture at the time for Lord of the Rings, named it the Palantir, which is a gruesome acronym for something I can't even recall. But basically, it was the idea of the Palantir, for those of you who are familiar with Tolkien-esque literature, referred to these seeing stones that allowed people to see through time and space. So it was kind of this nice idea of naming their telescope after this seeing stone idea. In any case, the idea was successful. Oh, the cost of this was estimated to be what today seems relatively cheap, about $100 million, but in 1977 was actually quite a deal of money, good deal of money. The proposal didn't go very far at the NSF for a number of different reasons. Overall, they felt that despite the fact that they were advocating a facility with a 25-meter aperture, they criticized Kitt Peak for coming up with designs that were too conservative. But one of the things that the NSF did credit Kitt Peak with, and Kitt Peak had this reputation through about the early part of the 1980s, was it really put the National Observatory at the forefront of thinking about new ways of designing and developing new telescopes. So for a period of time in the 1970s, when you were thinking, who's at the frontier of building big telescopes or thinking about ways of conceptualizing them, Kitt Peak was what would oftentimes come to people's mind. In 1980, by this point, Leo Goldberg had been forced out of the directorship at Kitt Peak, and he had been replaced by Jeffrey Burbidge. And the Next Generation Telescope Project morphs into this, something that becomes known as the National New Technology Telescope. And the size was downscaled from a 25-meter aperture to a 15-meter aperture. This is the winning design. Again, I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm talking to people, and there may be some people in the audience who actually participated in this process, and I'm aware of that because the University of California was one of the schools that competed with its design. This is the design that was put forth by the University of Arizona, and it was based on their multiple mirror concept. And ultimately in 1984, after what the participants called the Great Telescope Shootout in Santa Cruz, California, the Arizona design was chosen over the University of California design, which of course we all lovingly know as the Keck design now. But for several years, the National Science Foundation funded the NNTT program, but it was largely a telescope that existed on paper because the astronomy community was still grappling with the fundamental question of how do we make these large mirrors. You had people such as Jerry Nelson, former Caltech grad, former Livermore employee, particle physicist who became interested in large telescope design, advocating the segmented mirror concept, which many of you are familiar with and perhaps some of you have probably used. At the same time, this was going head-to-head with Roger Angel and the University of Arizona's work on developing these large monolithic honeycomb mirrors using a rotating oven and a bunch of other sort of apparatus. So for several years, there was a contentious battle between Nelson's design and the people who are advocating it and the design that Roger Angel and the group at the University of Arizona were pushing for. As I said, in 1984, this was finally resolved. The National Observatory announced the winner of its design. They were going to build this. Here, the idea was you have 4 8-meter mirrors on a common mount. You'd have a carousel of secondary mirrors, which could be rotated. So if you were going to do wide field versus infrared observing, you would sort of have this merry-go-round of secondary mirrors that you could spin and rapidly change over from one type of observing to another. After additional battles over whether to put the thing on Mount Graham or Mauna Kea, Mauna Kea won out, much to the delight of the Hawaiian congressional delegation that was carefully following where this thing was going to be placed. But the project really never developed the momentum that it needed to succeed, and for a couple of different reasons. People generally had a sense during the 1980s that the National Observatory had fallen behind the curve, technologically speaking, and that it wasn't up to the task of building a major new facility with a price tag of about $250 million. Another difficulty that this project faced was that the National Science Foundation never put its unabashed and full-hearted enthusiastic support behind it. In doing research for my book, I had the pleasure of reading several different congressional testimonies and hearings to the Appropriations Committee that funds the NSF, and they're really quite enlightening to see the timidity with which the NSF approached Congress for funding this sort of, you know, we'd like a new telescope, please. But at the same time, to their credit, the NSF was dealing with the fact that Congress had given bucket loads of money to NASA to build the Hubble Space Telescope. And in the eyes of the congressional appropriators, a telescope's a telescope. They didn't really care who was building it. And at the same time, the very large baseline or very long baseline array was being built. The VLA had just been completed. And in the words of one member of the Congressional Appropriations Committee, astronomers will take whatever they can get and they'll just keep coming back and asking for more. So in some sense, the NSF's timidity can be explained in that sense. Perhaps more fatal was the fact that the astronomy community never really made a single monolithic and concerted plea for this facility. There was a lot of divisiveness about whether the National Observatory should build it or whether private or state-run facilities should build it. So finally, skipping ahead, in 1987, ARA, the institute or the organization which manages the National Observatory, killed the project and decided to turn its attention instead to another project. And that, of course, became what we now know today as the Gemini Observatory, an 8-meter telescope on Mauna Kea and a twin telescope in Chile. But the path it would take to get to that was rocky indeed. However, I would argue that the NNTT program, despite the fact that it wasn't built, and some might say, well, it wasn't built and all this time and effort was spent on it, well, it must have been a failure. But I'd argue that it wasn't actually a failure. The investment that went into the program resulted in the successful funding and enhancement of the Stewart Observatory Mir Laboratory, which is still functioning today and still turning out mirrors, not as rapidly as one might think, but every couple years an 8-meter mirror pops out of the oven and is ready to go. And also the program led to improving and developing the technology that eventually found its way into the twin 10-meter Keck telescopes. So I think it's a little bit unfair to say this program is a failure simply because it wasn't built. And as I pointed out, eventually the National Observatory Eventually, the Gemini Observatory manages to get built. But in the process, the Gemini project is taken out of the hands of the National Observatory. It is, as you know, an international project. The U.S. has a 50%, or slightly less, actually, when you count in all the subtractions of time that go to the University of Hawaii and Chile and places like that. But the U.S. has about a 50% share in the project. But it was a very rough road to be built indeed. For those of you who have been in the astronomy community for quite some time, you may remember a very contentious battle for a couple years over the type of mirror that would go into the Gemini Observatory. For years, the design was predicated on using one of Roger Angel's monolithic honeycomb designs. And then, sort of at the last moment, the project changes its mind and decides to go with a thin meniscus mirror, like the very large telescope that ESO runs in Chile uses. And this prompted all sorts of recriminations and a very ugly political battle that reached all the way to Capitol Hill over what type of mirror would go in this project. So you can imagine the surprise of congressional staffers when 5, 6, 10 astronomers show up in their offices and are screaming bloody murder about something to them which is as trivial as what kind of mirror is going to go in our telescope. And again, the hearings and testimony and letters from this time are particularly revealing, and I will leave it at that. But clearly not a model process for anyone to follow. And of course, Corning retaliated by saying, well, you chose our mirror, and if you don't use it, we're going to sue your pants off, and your telescopes won't be built ever. So as you can imagine, the battle was quite ugly for several months. And one of the things that surprised me when I was doing the interviews for my book was that 10 years later, many of these wounds are still quite fresh among people, both at the National Observatory, at Corning, and at the University of Arizona, over what would seem a rather esoteric design decision. The second choice I wanted to talk today was talking about the planning leading up to the Next Generation Space Telescope. And for this, I'd like to acknowledge, I've been working on this project for about 5 years. I'm working on it with a colleague who is in the history department at the University of Alberta. His name is Robert Smith. And for those of you who might be familiar with the history of Hubble, Robert wrote in 1990, and that was later reprinted with an afterward, probably the best single history of the entire Hubble Space Telescope project. He traces the project from its beginnings in the 1960s all the way to the difficulties that it had in the 1990s and its successful repair. So if you want to read a really fascinating story about how NASA and politics and money and science all sort of came together in this project, I would really suggest you look at his book. But one of the things that we've been tracking in our work is trying to understand how the design for this particular national facility has come about. This is a little sketch that NASA had circa 1996. And this is something, it's called the Large Deployable Reflector, which its detractors call the Large Deplorable Reflector, in the 1980s. This was actually a project that has origins in the late 1970s at a meeting between people at NASA Ames and Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And they were aware of the fact that the Hubble Space Telescope looked like it was going to go forward. I don't think they appreciated how long it would take for it actually to be launched. But they were beginning to think about what the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope should look like. And this was one of the designs that they came up with. It was initially to be a 20-meter infrared telescope that would deploy itself in space using the segmented mirror concept that Jerry Nelson at the University of California was advocating. And has anyone actually in this room ever heard of this project? Curious bit of history. This project was heavily funded for about a period of about 7 or 8 years. NASA held regular conferences on it. I have volumes of conference proceedings and papers and articles. It was actually recommended by George Field's Decadal Review Committee in 1980. This was a very serious proposal that was being considered for almost a decade. And I find it fascinating that 20 years later, no one's heard of it. So for those, the Britney Spears of the world, This is what you have to look forward to, I guess. But this was conceived at a period in NASA history of what my colleague Robert refers to as the Imperial Age, when NASA was advocating extremely large and expensive space-based telescopes. It's the era that the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory and Hubble and Chandra and the Spitzer Telescope all come out of, these multi-billion-dollar missions. And some of them remain multi-billion-dollar missions, and then some like the Spitzer Telescope were gradually downsized and had to contend with that. But it was a very serious effort put forth by NASA, and they were very keen on developing this idea of deployable mirrors in space, and they had two different ideas. One was to develop a design where the mirror would fold itself up sort of like an origami something or other and then open up out in space. But the other idea that they were considering, and I wasn't able to find a picture of it, was that they were actually thinking of, of having astronauts build this thing in space. This was the era before the first space shuttle exploded, and it was seen as a very real alternative of launching the pieces into space and having astronauts bolt this thing together. And it was seen as a quite viable proposal. And for several years, NASA pursued this. And finally, around 1987, 1988, 89, and there, the enthusiasm for it begins to wane. They realize the difficulties that Hubble is having, and this thing sort of goes into hibernation. But the deployable mirror concept remains. And this is a picture that I was happily able to find on the web. The deployable mirror concept remains in part because the contractors who would be building the Large Deployable Reflector were developing expertise in other projects for deployable optics. And there was a real incentive to take this technology from one side of the world and transfer it into the civilian side. And this is an example of a project that TRW had. It was actually a microwave transmitting satellite that they launched several years ago. So the deployable mirror concept is something that survived the demise of the large deployable reflector. Another aspect that they were talking about very much in the late 1980s was, where do we put the successor to Hubble? It was pretty much thought that if you wanted to do an infrared telescope, you wanted to get it as far away from the Earth as possible. You wanted to have it out in the cold blackness of space. That was one idea that was being talked about. Another idea that was talked about was the successor to Hubble should be put on the moon. For those of you who perhaps recall, in 1989, the first President Bush stood on the steps of the National Air and Space Museum and called for America to return to the moon, which was music to NASA's ears, and immediately they began to swing into gear and think about all the interesting things that they could do if we were to return to the moon. And somebody said, well, hey, these astronomers want to build a next generation space telescope, let's build it on the moon. This one didn't last so long. I think after about a year, people said, it's just not going to work. Sort of, for those of you who recall, in January of this year, we were going to go to the moon, and we're not hearing a whole lot about that anymore. But it did spark the interest of astronomers in putting the successor to Hubble in a place other than an Earth orbit, which is another design feature that remained. We're all familiar with this fellow, launched in 1990, repaired in 94. However, the difficulties that Hubble had in this period between when the spherical aberration with its optics was discovered and diagnosed and when it was repaired, because of the negative press and the publicity and the fact that you couldn't watch David Letterman for a period of time without hearing jokes about the Hubble Space Telescope, basically sort of forced the next generation telescope project into the closet. So for 3 or 4 years in the early 1990s, the project goes into hibernation. Once Hubble is successfully repaired, once amazing and truly beautiful pictures began to come back from it, next generation space telescope pops back out of the closet again. In 1992, NASA also gets a new administrator, Dan Golden, a former TRW executive. And Golden is an advocate of the faster, better, cheaper philosophy. And Golden, for the next generation space telescope project, is in many ways the right man at the right time. In 1996, he attends an American Astronomical Society meeting, and he chastises astronomers for thinking too small. He chastises them for relying upon manna from heaven that comes from the Defense Department, reminding them that the Hubble Space Telescope was basically a keyhole satellite that had been retooled to point in the other direction, and saying, you know, you guys can't rely on this thing, you know, getting all these gifts from the Defense Department forever. You need to go out and think bold and think outside the box. And he encourages astronomers to begin to think not about building a 3 or 4 meter successor to Hubble, but instead says, why don't you think really big? We're building 8 meter telescopes on the ground. Let's think of an 8 meter telescope in space. And let's put it at one of the Lagrangian points, and we're going to do this whole thing for $500 million. Well, and I apologize for the crudeness of this next slide, but it was sent to me by somebody at NASA. I didn't make this. I was asking somebody once about the faster, better, cheaper philosophy, and he said, I'll send you a PowerPoint slide that kind of indicates what some of us thought here about it. Not all of us, but some of us. So in any case, the faster, better, cheaper philosophy, you know, it worked in some areas, but it didn't work very well for next generation space telescope, and the budget and the schedule began to go in one direction and the other, and not in a good way, if you understand what I'm saying. And then, of course, one of the other difficulties that NASA began to have is they realized that they're not going to be able to build these next generation space telescopes as cheaply as they can, and they begin to become a little bit concerned with the risk. So especially after the Columbia accident, you see a return in the NASA management philosophy to one that's extremely risk averse. So for those of you who followed NGST, and I started to pay attention to it in 1999, it was in 1999 it was an extremely bold and ambitious program. They were talking about launching it without testing certain components of it and really just kind of winging it. And I remember going into Goddard Space Flight Headquarters on the second floor where the NGST offices were located, and the project manager had this big poster that he called the Pirate Code. And basically it was talking about how in order to build space telescopes cheaper, you needed to think like a pirate. And I never really understood what he was talking about, but I think he was kind of saying you needed to sort of think boldly and be willing to take risks and wear tights. I'm not sure. But he was definitely advocating a certain willingness to embrace risk philosophy. And in a couple of years, it became pretty clear that Goldwyn was being eased out. Sean O'Keefe came in as NASA administrator, So Sean O'Keefe comes in. It's very much a more risk-averse philosophy. And very quickly, you see NGST going from an 8-meter telescope in space to what is it now, a 6.5-meter telescope, maybe a 6-meter telescope in space. And the design, the cost for it rather, have gone from about $500 million to the latest estimates that I'm seeing are getting close to $1 billion. So it's tending to follow the same trajectory that Hubble did. Interestingly enough, when Darren Golden gave that speech at the AAS meeting in January of 96, it did provoke a response from NASA, and very quickly, within 3 or 4 months, this is one of the engineers at Goddard, a page from his notebook that he gave me, NASA had indeed come up with this really bold idea of a 8-meter telescope that folds out into space with a sun shield protecting it, and all of the design features that we still see today with the James Webb Space Telescope design. So thinking about these projects that you might call failures, the National New Technology Telescope and the Large Deployable Reflector, I think there are some lessons that you could draw from them that may have some applicability as you think about, or as one thinks about, building the next generation of big instruments. First of all, I think you need to ask yourself, what does it mean to be a technological failure? And as I've argued, just because something isn't built doesn't mean that it's a failure. That oftentimes the experience and the knowledge and the expertise that you get from working with different ideas, even if they're only on paper, can actually have real payoffs down the line. The sort of the negative or the converse of that, or the bad side, if you will, is that many times these design features become embedded into the system. As with the James Webb Space Telescope, the idea of a deployable mirror has been around now for at least 20 years. NASA seems extremely wedded to the idea of a deployable mirror, and I don't find it a coincidence that Dan Golden, former TRW executive, who knows an awful lot about what TRW's classified operations are doing, is advocating for astronomers to build an 8-meter deployable mirror concept. As near as I could get him to speak about this, the general sense that I received was he was aware of what TRW was able to do on the black side of things and was just hoping that astronomers would be able to duplicate it on the civilian side of things. And I also don't think it's a coincidence that the first project manager for what was then Next Generation Space Telescope was also a former TRW executive with experience from the classified world. So clearly NASA was picking people who had experience and knowledge from the reconnaissance world and hoping that they were going to then transfer it into the civilian side. I think I just made my second point, that you have the legacy and momentum of these technological choices, and for better or for ill, sometimes these design features just persist throughout the life of a program. The future isn't what it used to be. Funding for the physical sciences, of course, changes with the science budget being what it is after September 11th, with money being directed to homeland security and with international collaboration sort of being the watchword of the day. It'll be very interesting to see what happens with these large projects. Another point to mention is that the era, I sometimes wonder if the Keck Telescope project will be the last large science facility to be built almost entirely with money from a philanthropist. I understand that Gordon Moore has contributed generously to the idea of building a 30-meter telescope, but when you start getting to projects that are $1 billion or more, I think you're beginning to even tap out the resources of your wealthiest single patron, and you're almost necessitating that some type of partnership emerge between the private and the federal sector, which then, of course, can lead to strange bedfellows. And For those of you who are involved in any way with the 30-meter telescope project, or who follow the ARRO webpage and read about the letters going back and forth between Bill Smith, the president of ARRO, and people at Carnegie and the University of Arizona about the design for the 30-meter telescope, you can see that a large number of these issues, these community issues and more sociological issues, are still being ironed out in the community. Perhaps not in as dramatic of a fashion as the king meeting Tricky Dick, but in some way or another. So I leave you then with a sign that I plucked from the Cornell Astronomy Department, with apologies to Socrates, and thanks to the generous people who funded the work that I've done, and thanks to you for listening to me. Different how?
They seem to get more unified.
Yeah.
And the wounds seem to heal. Now, the projects that allow you to see, they're the famous failures.
Oh, yeah.
But they fail in a unified way.
We're all going down together. I think that's very interesting. Can you all hear me without this?
Okay. We're recording, leave it on.
Oh, that's right. Sorry about that. Sorry to posterity for my question. One of the arguments that I try to make in my book, or questions I ask, is has ground-based astronomy become like high-energy physics in terms of how it builds and funds its instruments? I think in many ways it has, with the simple exception that high-energy physics now is entirely funded by the federal government, whereas still today, and it'll be interesting to see where it is 25 years from now, still today the private and state investment in ground-based astronomy is very large. I think an interesting question, sort of echoing what you said, is why has the radio astronomy community been able to do it more successfully than the optical astronomy community? There was a fractious set of arguments in the 1950s about building a national radio astronomy observatory, but once the NSF committed to doing that, and once NRAO was funded and began to be built in Green Bank and then out in Socorro, those arguments went away, and the radio astronomy community seems to be much more united behind picking its next big machine and building it. You know, I give you ALMA and, you know, whatever else is coming down the line. What is it, the square kilometer array thing, and all those different things. So I think a more interesting question is why have the radio astronomers been able to do it and the optical astronomers haven't? I have a couple thoughts, but I'll save those.
To what extent do you think the interaction with
I don't know if it's made a difference in terms of the building of instruments, but I can recall before moving here, I lived in Washington, D.C., so it was easy for me to go to meetings at the NSF or the National Academy of Sciences, and they were always very illuminating to go to. But I can remember going to one where, what's the former head of physics at NSF, Eisen? Yeah, it was, I remember him giving a speech to the Committee on Astronomy and Astrophysics, and he reminded them that their days of entitlement were over. That was a direct quote, that they couldn't just expect the NSF to pony up the money for whatever they wanted, and that they needed to speak with a more clear and unified voice in the way that the high-energy physics community was doing. So I think he was looking at them perhaps as an organizational model of saying, you know, if you want to get a 30-meter telescope built, you all need to figure out amongst yourselves what it is you want to build before it gets up to my level where it begins to attract political attention. And just as an aside, and I just want to mention, I think it's a humorous anecdote, I mentioned the Gemini Observatory earlier. One of the other difficulties that it had, besides going international and facing the mirror controversy, was that it was also competing with other big NSF projects at the time, namely LIGO. LIGO and Gemini were funded in the same, they were supposed to be funded in the same year, in 1991. Gemini got the money and LIGO got nothing that year. The people advocating LIGO were really upset about this, and they came back, and I think they were talking to Chet somebody, Atkins, somebody, one of the congressional people on the Appropriations Committee, and they were talking about, you know, how we want to get these big projects funded, and the NSF was making their case for their big projects, and the Congress was saying, you know, you all need to figure out which big project it is you want to build first rather than trying to build them all at one time. And the director of the NSF at that time, a former industrial engineer by the name of Eric Block, said, well, you know, we're doing a lot of soul searching here. We're trying to figure out what we want to do. And it was a memorable quote because I thought it was particularly snappy for a congressperson. Said, well, you know, it's a lot cheaper to search your soul than it is to search for a black hole. So I thought that was actually really funny. I kind of wondered if maybe one of his staff members hadn't written it out to give to him, because I thought that was just right on the ball there. All right. Easy audience. Thanks.
I think you were right on track when you speculated that the advent of 30-meter class telescopes is changing its culture. Right?
How do you see it changing? Because you're involved with it. I'm just watching it.
If you look back, right, to the advent of the 4-meter class telescopes, I mean, the United States is unique in the sense of how wealthy the wealthiest segment of the population is. And, I mean, private money could be found to, in parallel, build the Palomar telescope and build the 4-meter class telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
And much of the same thing happened with the Keck Observatory being built and Gemini and Magellan more or less being built in parallel.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, with people now in the 30-meter class era, I mean, there's already been significant attempts to merge the Caltech DC telescope with
yeah.
Gemini and Canadian proposals to do similar things.
Mm-hmm.
Although there's still some outliers in that game. Need has been seen, I think.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that the thing that has really spurred it on is the fact that the Europeans really got their act together and did combine their resources to...
And are making plans to build a 100-meter telescope, which, yeah. I mean, I find that, I mean, one of the things, again, I tried to point out in the book was the fact that the American astronomy community and just the international community really is to be congratulated. I mean, in 1980, they weren't even sure that they could manage to build an 8-meter telescope. It wasn't a definite thing. And when you look around the world now, how many 8-meter class telescopes are there? I mean, you have the two Magellan telescopes, the 6.5-meter, you have the multiple mirror, you have the four VLTs, you have Subaru, you have, what am I leaving? You have the two Kecks, you have Gemini. I mean, you have almost... You have a Hobby Eberle, you have the SALT telescope. I mean, somewhere in the neighborhood of a dozen to 15, 8, 6.5 to 10-meter telescopes. That's remarkable to be able to marshal and bring together the resources to build that. If you think that it's going to be able to happen again, where you're going to get 13 to 15 30-meter class telescopes on the ground at $1 billion apiece, and remember the operating costs for these usually tend to be about 10% of the construction costs, you know, for $100 million to operate a 30-meter telescope, you can build another Keck telescope. That, I think, is going to be a real interesting thing to see. I wouldn't put my money on it. I would bet that you might see two or three of them built, you know, one by the Europeans and maybe one or two in the U.S. But I don't think we're going to see just a massive surge of telescope building the way we saw in the 1990s, which I really do think is quite remarkable. Thank you. Oops.